Hello, friends. This is Katrine. Before we begin our Voices episode, I wanted to let you know that Mormon Expression is running a campaign to keep our studio in Salt Lake City. The studio is used for recording Mormon Expression, the Reasonability Podcast, Mormon Expression Voices, and occasionally even Feminist Mormon Housewives. It's also a place where we hold workshops or classes. It is open to anyone who wants to use the studio for community or private events. So we ask if you have the ability to please donate money so we can continue these podcasts and events in the future. Simply visit MormonExpression.com and there is a button on the right-hand corner of the screen to make a donation. Thank you so much. And please enjoy this next episode of Mormon Expression Voices.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Mormon Expression Voices. My name is Keith, and I will be your host today. I am sitting in my basement with two wonderful people who have been gracious enough to come to my home and be interviewed for the podcast, the Shaws. Hello.
Hi there.
Hello.
Alan and Julianne. Thank you for being here. So the Shaws have a very interesting bunch of stories. We're going to try and get to as many of them as we can. Potentially stories that have not been told on the podcast before. And so I'm really excited to hear more about them. But to start out, if you guys want to go ahead and tell us a little bit about your history in terms of Mormonism and how you came to be where you find yourselves today.
All right. Well, we both claim the pioneer heritage for generations, and born under the covenant. My father was a seminary teacher. About when I was age 12, he was sent to Canada to teach Institute of Religion at the University of Alberta. So I went from being in a town in Idaho with almost 100% Mormons, to I think in the whole elementary school, our family was only one with kids there, LDS. In junior high, there was one other family, So that was really an opportunity for me to look at myself and what difference it made to be a Mormon compared to kids that weren't. And I remember sharing a Joseph Smith story. We had a record with it with one of my friends and, standing up to standards that I felt were important to me. One of my close friends up there was Catherine Card, and it's the Card family after whom Cardston, Alberta is named. So that was that pioneer heritage too. And it was interesting to connect into that and to see the church grow. We just lived a few blocks from the Institute building on campus. So
that was in Edmonton, right?
This was in Edmonton, Alberta. Yeah. So, the summer I turned 16, my dad was invited to get his doctorate, and we moved to Springville, and that was nice. I finished high school there and then went on to BYU and graduated in elementary education. But I remember when I went home for Thanksgiving, I started thinking about what am I going to do when I get out of school? What does the Lord want me to do? What's interesting is that I had spent one summer, I was in the Hilcomore pageant, as one of the sisters. We had busloads of sisters from BYU go out there to be in the pageant. And at that time, I thought, no, I don't want a mission. But it was November of my senior year. I felt like that's what I was to do. So when I came home at Christmas time, I had the interviews. And I got my call like in March, and that was kind of fun. My sister and I worked at the cafeteria at the Smith Family Living Center, the old building that used to be there. And we were on lunch when a roommate called and said, "You got your call came. All of us are here except you two. Can we open it? Can we open it?" and I go, "Just a second here. I got all my friends at work right here. My sister's right here. All my roommates are together in this moment. why not? At least find out where I'm going. So, it was to Denmark. So then, of course, when I went home, I got to read over all the letters, and I was pretty shocked to be going to a foreign speaking mission because I was a sister. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I just,
they have sisters everywhere.
Now, but
so
they did.
When would this have been?
Early 70s.
So that was 73.
Okay.
Yeah. So I graduated from BYU.
Not quite as common, especially as now.
Now, sister missionaries weren't as common, but somehow, even growing up, I would always imagine being a missionary mm-hmm. as I listened to the elders return. And I now and again remind myself, look here, girl, why am I? But here, I went on a mission. But I went right when we were transitioning from the flannel board discussions to the flip charts that mm-hmm. were developed under Harold B. Lee. Mm-hmm. And, Harold B. Lee is who signed my mission call. And, we got to meet with him in the Salt Lake Temple as part of our missionary mm-hmm. preparation back then.
See, back then you actually got the real signature, not the auto pen. So at least you have that.
Yes. But then he helps and passes away while we're on our mission, I think.
But so you went through the temple prior to getting married then. What was
I had
done like for you? And this is all pre-1990 too, so.
This is true.
With the penalties.
So.
With the penalties and the 2-year wrist and ankles, mm-hmm. temple garments and all that.
The true garments.
Oh yes. In fact, I learned from my mom that her father never quit wearing those 100% of the time.
Based on what I understand, there was kind of this subculture when they went to the shorter garments that it was just like, okay, you can wear those, but those aren't, means that you're not for real. It's like, now there were tiers of righteousness. You have the fully righteous with the, you know, ankle and wrist, the sort of righteous with the regular, you know, length, and then of course the unrighteous heathens who don't wear them at all.
But anyway, you know, that was fine. But in Denmark, I came over with the new discussions. Mm-hmm. My companion had only been out 2 months more than me, so the idea of only speaking Danish was a bit absurd. We had good experiences, but I was only in the country for 3 months when all the sisters were pulled out, and I was reassigned to England East Mission.
Okay.
And that's where Alan happened to be serving.
That's where we met.
Oh, okay.
So we'll
let's go back and hear your bit up to that point, and then we'll progress.
Combine
from there.
The two, huh?
Yep.
Like my wife said, we're both pioneer heritage. Both parents very strong in the church. Grew up in Orem and Southern California.
Well, there is a contrast. We had regular family scripture time and family home evening in a father who taught institute. Mm. He had one or two family home evenings.
You had a healthy time growing up.
Yeah. That's the apostate.
He had a working mother. I had a stay-at-home mother.
Okay, so, you know, your family embraced the short garments right on.
That's right.
Whereas your grandfather.
Speaking of garments, my grandfather was part owner of a radio station, mm-hmm. KOVO in Provo. Back in the 60s, they used to broadcast the BYU football game before they became popular and KSL grabbed them. Mm-hmm. Because they lost just about every game back in those days. Anyway, my grandfather worked at KSL before KOVO, and he was when Richard Evans, the guy that was behind the voice,
the spoken word,
when he gets sick, my grandfather would take over for him.
Okay.
And I remember going through the temple for the first time, and prior to 1990, they had what's called a lecture at the Veil.
Uh huh.
If you remember, I don't know.
I didn't go through prior to 90. I'm fairly familiar with the history. I don't know how many people are, but they've been changing that thing all over the place. The lecture at the Veil, as I understand it, was added by Brigham Young, or at least bits of it were added by Brigham Young and then taken back out. And then they pulled it all completely after 90. So,
well, actually a lot of the things that were in the lecture at the Veil were put into the 1990 endowment.
Okay,
they just kind of stuck them in there. So They used to give the lecture at the Vale to people who were going through for their own endowments for the first time. Mm-hmm. So usually you'd stay in the endowment room. Everyone, all the people who had been through before would mm-hmm. leave, and you and a couple others okay. would stay and get the lecture at the Vale. Well, my grandfather was the voice for that. And I didn't know he was the voice for that until I went through for the first time. And I thought, this sounds very familiar. And my father elbowed me and said, that's your grandfather, that's your grandfather.
Be proud.
Be proud, yeah. So, got a mission call, was signed by, hers was signed by, my wife's was signed by Harold Bailey. Mm-hmm. Mine was signed by Joseph Fielding Smith.
Okay.
Just before he died. So, England East Mission, which was later changed to the England London Mission. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then we can do the, we met.
Yeah. This was all pre Spencer Kimball and telling missionaries to lock their hearts. So you guys are green lit.
We grew up with, David O. McKay became president of the church in April. I was born in mm-hmm. June. And here I am a student at BYU.
Oh, yeah.
Before he passed away.
Yeah, your whole growing up life was David McKay.
Yeah. 100%.
So Julie was assigned to the mission home after a few months, and she was the mission
receptionist.
Receptionist. She
did
dress.
Heaven forbid you be proselyting. Sorry.
No, I did my first area knocking on doors.
So she'd address all the mail for the missionaries. Mm-hmm. The mail would come to the mission home, and she'd readdress it to the wherever the missionaries were.
And I'd answer the phone. And back in those days, it was a lot of youth interest in the church because they were Donny Osmond fans. And in the school system, they had a class on religion. So when they'd look up in the phone book and want to learn about our church, they got my number. So I had interesting calls.
Plenty of interesting questions.
I had plenty of proselyting to do right there. And not only that, the mission home was above Hyde Park Chapel.
Okay.
And while we were there, they made an area of
a visitor center.
Mm-hmm. And my companion and I even helped paint a big, tall post sign out front advertising organ recitals.
Okay.
That would draw people in because it was right along a street with museums and you could walk to Hyde Park. It was in an area that
a lot of foot traffic.
So one thing that was a little shift for me was you're glad on a mission, you're glad for anybody to come to church. A lot of women didn't own dresses.
Mm-hmm.
So come into church with whatever you wore, especially there, why this visitor center had to be acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
And it felt right to me. I thought it shouldn't make that much difference. God's just happy we're here, right?
Oh, I could tell you about conversations with my father where he would vehemently disagree with you. Again, I was a missionary in northern Brazil. And so it's that thing where it's like, if you show up, I don't care what you're wearing. We had people coming in shorts and t-shirts and flip-flops, but they were there. I mean, the branch I spent most of my mission in, I spent 8.5 months in one branch.
Probably didn't own anything else, didn't they?
Well, and we had like 15 active members. So if they showed up at all, if I didn't have to bless and pass the sacrament and give a talk, aces.
Right.
I got assigned to the mission home as well. And the previous mission president, Belknap, his reign was 69 to 72. My mission president was 72 to 75, I guess.
Okay. Now, had you been out before Alan arrived? Or were you guys kind of simultaneously?
He had been out earlier.
Earlier, okay.
We ended off the same because mine was 18 months and his was 2 years.
Thanks. That's just for my curiosity.
We ended up coming home together.
Hey, well, apparently.
So they had this folk singing group in the mission home that practiced there. And then they would do concerts for members that they could invite their friends to. And we'd also sing on the streets while the elders and sisters would street contact in front of us.
Man, where was stuff like this when I was a missionary?
It didn't last long, let me tell you. When the, I think the next mission president got rid of it, so he thought it was just too too modern.
I could have spent my mission singing, playing guitar and stuff, man.
He was the lead singer for...
It was called The Family Album, was the name of the group.
Okay.
So I was in an area later where I was involved with members in hosting a family album concert.
Okay.
It was the group after him, but... So I saw both aspects, being in the mission home and having the group practice. And actually, I think during that time I had you come and sing for family.
Could have been.
Yeah.
Anyway, there's an interesting story about Belknap.
Yeah, but please.
When Belknap was, and this is prior to me getting there, but his legacy carried on over into my mission president's, maybe the first year, year and a half. So he tended to put a lot of pressure on the missionaries to get converts. This is nothing new. We've all heard this story repeated over and over again in the Philippines and South America, Japan. And just prior to this, in the baseball baptism era in the 60s, they called it the hurt. The pressure that he would put on the APs, who would put on the zone leaders, who would put on the district leaders, who would put on the missionaries. They call it the hurt or the, I guess, and, or they call it flogging. Flogging. I remember the term flogging a lot. So he put a lot of pressure. There were a lot of people baptized that should never have been baptized. I think there were several missionaries who got emotional disturbances from having to baptize people who shouldn't have been baptized, simply to fulfill a goal that the mission president wanted. I don't know why he wanted to do it. Maybe he was bucking for a general authority position. Who knows why he did it.
So with that, there was all of that pressure. How did that shake out? In the letter that you wrote in, you mentioned that Bruce McConkie had to come out and iron out the whole situation. Let's jump ahead to...
Well, not only did Belknap put a great deal of pressure on the missionaries, but they used to teach a lot of mysteries in at zone meetings and zone conferences and district meetings. So they called it dodgy doctrine back in those days.
Oh, see, I call it everything that used to make Mormonism interesting. correlation killed all the cool stuff.
It killed all the cool stuff. So when my mission president, Mylon Smith, came into the mission field, he had all these missionaries teaching doctrine he'd never heard of before. He had all these missionaries who were still traumatized by the pressure. And so he was trying to loosen up things. And apparently he did a lot of complaining to Salt Lake about it, but apparently it's common practice for new mission presidents to complain against old mission presidents. And so Salt Lake essentially just ignores it. Because he didn't do it a certain way, he's got to be an apostate mission president. Finally, he got the ear of some general authority, and they sent Bruce R. McConkie over to straighten the mess out.
Okay.
So he interviewed each of the missionaries. He had a mission conference where he went around the room and asked each of the elders and sisters what doctrines they had been taught, and some of the doctrines were just way out there. And I remember one in particular, I'll have to mention it to you. He asked this missionary what doctrine he had been taught, and he said, "Did Parley P. Pratt go to the moon and baptize people?" Now, he said this with a straight face, and the whole place just erupted in wild laughter. And I remember looking at Bruce R. McConkie, and he just had this very stern look on his on his face, and he said, "Elder, that's utter nonsense. That was taken out of the ethereal blue." Anyway, he did eventually straighten it all out and took care of it.
Okay, so you guys... So
one of the things that we took home from this was here you had a lot of missionaries responding to the leadership of mission president and going against their own conscience. And so part of Bruce R. McConkie's message was to maybe own our own spiritual guidance more.
I'm not sure that was it so much as he, some of the elders had dusted their feet off at various doorsteps, and he told us that he had taken that priesthood responsibility away from us as an apostle. I thought, can he really do that?
I mean, they took all the responsibilities away by the time I was doing the mission. We couldn't cast out demons or anything.
Well, I felt like, you know, if you're not sure that a leader that you have is operating correctly, at least go to the leader above, you know, and I wondered, well, what if some of the missionaries had reported or written, you know, about what they were being taught. But then, you know, I go, all right, so all these missionaries go home. How many of them share this stuff actually with their stake presidents, or do you just?
Oh, it all just bleeds.
Toe the party line.
all the weird stuff just bleeds into their family beliefs. I mean, I know that even growing up in the 80s, I was still catching hints of a lot of the stuff that's been disavowed now in terms of the priesthood and temple ban for black folks.
Right.
And that was still, I mean, this was 1989, 1990. That was still kind of coming.
So my mission actually ended a few...
mission ended a few weeks before Julie's did. And I stayed over to do genealogy.
He just made air quotes.
But the real reason was to go home with my future wife. Now, our mission president and his wife were matchmakers, and they kind of set us up. And my mission president, Mylon Smith, was the president of the temple committee raising money for the Washington D.C. temple when he was stake president there. And our missions ended about October, November of 74. And that was when the Washington D.C. temple was being dedicated. So the first presidency invited him and his wife, who invited us to go to the temple dedication on our way home.
So that worked out, and that was a special experience for us. We actually ended up with several days in the D.C. area. Sister Gates had already gone home from our mission, and I stayed with her. Alan stayed with Elder Watermeyer, who was home and lived in the vicinity. Mm-hmm. But during the day, we could meet up. And
you guys got to just hang out.
And they didn't, our mission brother didn't care.
Very cool. Very cool.
We actually caved in and held hands.
Before we were released.
I'm not sure you want to admit that. People listen to this. I don't know how many. So once you got home, then how long did it take for you guys to get hitched?
We got home in November of 74. We were married in May of 75.
We were engaged in December, right?
It didn't take long.
Did you guys know pretty early on that was the road you wanted to go down? You guys been married now for 29 years then, right?
During that time in D.C. is where we really started feeling like we had found the right person. But so we said, wait, let's go home. Let's date others. Let's get out of the mission mindset, get back to reality, and check this out. But
we'll date others for 2 weeks, and then
we'll try dating one other person. Nah.
It didn't work.
So then you guys got married in the temple, the whole nine yards?
Yes. Mm-hmm. My family lived in Mesa at that time, so we chose the Mesa temple. It's most convenient. Right. His family was in California.
And then you started down the traditional road.
We did.
At this juncture. You get a little bit non-traditional further on, and that's kind of where I want to go from here.
But as far as the traditional part, I think that we were of the mindset to drink the Kool-Aid.
Mm-hmm.
And we only drank the Kool-Aid. I think we made the Kool-Aid. In fact, we stored the Kool-Aid in our basement. That's how devout we were. That'll come out later on here, but some of the crazy things we did, I don't know, I just shake my head now. But
our first was born the day he graduated from
airframe and power plant school. I'm an aircraft mechanic by trade, so fix airplanes for a living.
So then he got a job working for Surveyor up in Alaska. We were there a couple years, and he tried to get on the pipeline or get a better job than just gassing airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
and ended up in Saudi Arabia. We were there about 5 years, and our membership in the church had to do with suddenly leaving. And so that is a story. But our family there was members of the church. There was operating, mm-hmm. Became a stake during our stay. We fell under the international mission, mm-hmm. and had
we got
really
kicked out.
We had really
because we were Mormons out of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia.
Now, so I have a question about that. I mean, okay. We won't go really into that story, but based on the fact that you both have lineage going back to pioneer times and people getting expelled from places, did you guys feel that that helped you relate with your ancestors in any way? Getting ejected from a place as a result of your beliefs? I mean, I know for me, I don't think that that's why the Mormons got kicked out of anywhere anymore. But you know, when I was an active member, that's how I would have. What was that like?
I think that we probably thought to ourselves that we're just like the early pioneers.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the prophecy that the gospel would fill the earth. Every country needed to have it shared. Well, Saudi Arabia is a protectorate for the sacred sites for the Muslim religion, mm-hmm. for Islam. So this was a way. I mean, they took confiscated things from people's homes. Mm-hmm. We were interviewed. So they had leaders, people in their country, learning about our faith. Eventually, we were given verbal permission for members to meet there in groups of 25 or less. Mm-hmm. I mean, the whole time we were there, we had to keep quiet. Mm-hmm. So we felt like that was a missionary work. And the other thing was, when we got there, during the 5 years we were there, there was quite a bit of transformation. It was beautified, including garbage can workers from New York coming over with their blue garbage trucks and uniforms and literally cleaning up the trash.
So this is when all the oil money started coming in.
Well, the oil money was there, but
a lot of
being used.
Yeah, a lot of landscaping, mm-hmm. and road development. Okay. And so it's like the general authorities that visited said, it's our present in this country. It's blossoming like a rose here, like it did in Salt Lake when the saints came. So we had that image in our minds, that comparison.
You know, of course, that was all just BS. Well,
we believed it.
Nobody takes credit for the good things that happen like Mormons. Nobody claims that they're persecuted. Well, I guess a lot of people claim they're persecuted like Mormons, but you know, Mormons, man, we're able to take anything and turn it into persecution. So you've come back to the United States.
Yep. And, we were able to build out on property that we live today and have a great place to raise our kids where they were close to my family. Mm-hmm. We initially, you know, moved in with my folks, but we had already invested in some property in the area, and we're eventually able to build on it along with my brother and his sister. And
when she says the area, she means Gilbert, Arizona.
Gilbert.
Yeah. So
we were the Kool-Aid.
Did you guys participate?
We had the food storage. We had
at least 2 years of food storage, maybe three or four of some things.
We had 3 or 4 days usually growing up in my house.
And then he got to the point of having three years worth for us, our children, and our grandchildren.
That's a lot of food, man.
Yeah, I'm still working on getting rid of it. Using it.
Anybody want any wheat? Just
let me know.
Just kind of a shout. Anybody want any wheat? Come over to our house.
So with that, were you guys participating in different callings all along the way? And
I was in a bishopric. Julie was in primary presidencies.
No, I only was in primary presidency in Saudi Arabia.
Oh, okay.
In the U.S., it started out in primary, but mostly I did scouting.
Oh, okay.
Cub scouting.
Bless you.
And I was still in scouting as we transitioned in our faith.
It takes a special person who's going straight to heaven to do scouting. I tell my kids, scout leaders, I couldn't do it. Actually, that's the only calling I've ever said no to.
The fun years when Alan was the cub master and I was a committee chair. Of course, I enjoyed being actually a den leader better, but I was a committee chair for a long time. I even got involved on the district level. So, right. Alan tended to have 2 or 3 callings. When he'd be asked for a fourth, he said, you'll have to release me on something if you want to take on this.
This other. So you guys.
We had a real good reputation in the ward. I mean, whatever callings we did well.
You guys were the cogs that made things run. The welfare. It sounds like people who showed up.
Right. I think that we were well respected. Probably not so much now.
But, and you were a temple worker. That was one of those.
Ah.
I was a temple worker during the time when they changed the initiatory back in 2005.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember an interesting story about that. One of the guy that was in charge of the temple department, he's a general authority, I don't remember his name, but he came down to the Mesa Temple while we were doing the training for it. And we asked him during one of the training sessions, why are we changing this?
Mm-hmm.
Well, all he would say is, President Hinckley says so. Well, we found out that behind closed doors, the temple president asked him the same question, and he said it's because of a lawsuit over inappropriate touching.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the reason why we're changing it.
I heard a whole different story, that they ran a focus group that said, we don't like it anymore.
Well, that was probably true as well, but I think that it...
I can imagine the inappropriate touching situation could have driven that particular change. So are we okay to move on to you guys getting involved in these communities? This is so interesting to me. So everybody who's listening, this is so outside of my scope of Mormonism. So let's talk about
that. Well, you know, one of
that.
Our beliefs is in the coming forth of scriptures in latter days. Mm-hmm. So we know, looking
sure
forward
we,
to this.
Are you sure we really believe that?
Well, I did. So profoundly that I got to experience that in my life.
So the part in the Book of Mormon where it talks about the sealed portion.
Mm-hmm.
And the sealed portion is supposed to eventually come forward.
Mm-hmm.
And I always thought, well, of course, some church leader is going to
be involved
with the sealed portion. He's going to bring it forward and present it to the world.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now my mindset is that'll never happen in the LDS Church.
Okay, so first, was it being on a preparedness site, sharing stuff that we first learned about Cloud Pilot? Oh, which group? There was an offshoot Mormon group studying the scriptures, studying prophecies. Mm-hmm. We were probably involved.
Okay.
I mean, we had serious study, Second Coming stuff, study Isaiah.
But this part of what was driving your food storage was like this real belief that
yes,
stuff was going to go down and soon, and
absolutely,
you wanted to be as prepared as possible for
correct.
That.
And we had the guns to go to protect the food storage too.
Okay, so anyway, we learn about scriptures that had come forth through in Indians. All right, so.
And this is Cloud Pilot.
This is Cloud Pilot.
Okay. And this is the Mentina Archives.
Okay, can you explain a little bit what that is? Because I'm not sure many people are super.
The Mentina Archives. Let me tell you what they are first, and then we can talk about where they came from.
Okay,
but what they are is that the Mentina Archives start in chapter 63 of Alma. They start at that point there where Hagoth builds a ship, sails off to the great unknown, and is never heard from again. That's where the Mentina Archives start.
Okay.
Okay. So that, the Book of Mormon account is about Hagoth the son, Hagoth the father. The Mentina Archives he builds a ship, sails along the western coast of South America, up north along Mexico, into the Gulf of California.
Mm-hmm.
When they get to where the Colorado River dumps into the Gulf of California, they build canoes, they paddle up the Colorado River.
They have a story of going through the Grand Canyon area.
Now, how they paddle up the Grand Canyon, I'll never know, but this is how the story goes. Yeah.
This makes for an intriguing story.
It does.
So do millions and millions of people in a battle that we can't find any evidence of. But
so anyway, where the river turns a sharp
north
is where they initially got out.
Okay.
And that's where they built a city called the people were called the Nemanhaw.
Okay.
All right. So where the river turns north is approximately near Tuba City, Arizona, Page, Arizona, somewhere in that general vicinity, you know, just south of Lake Powell.
So apparently, back in those days, it was a lovely forested area.
Oh.
And so it continues on. We get to the Gadi Anton robbers coming in and things taking over. And the original people it started off with six Lamanite families, six Nephite families.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, they go up into Utah, closer to Manti and that area, right?
Right. To get away from them. Well, first of all, they denude the
So the robbers, the people that followed mm-hmm. them denuded the forest and
sent all the timber down the river.
And that's why there's no forest there now.
That's right.
According to the archives, yes. Well,
okay. So this was all
brought forth. So Cloudpiler is a quarter in Cherokee Indian or something like that?
Nez Perce.
Okay. Anyway, we actually had him to our home. And my father, seminary teacher, comes and listens to him and mm-hmm. actually reads his first book or so. And it's interesting. And he feels a good spirit. And one of the fun things about it is the role of women and prophetesses and...
The ordained women movement would love this book.
There was a lot more verse on how to live a Zion community. Because mm-hmm. Christ not only visited, in Bountiful, but he came up and visited here in Utah.
Okay.
In fact, there was another group farther out east. So it contains accounts of Christ visiting America and mm-hmm. so on.
Visiting multiple groups.
Right. I mean, it was only confirming what we believed.
Mm-hmm.
But it also had this... Cloudpiler said that the Indians, they anticipated Brigham Young coming. I mean, there were those who mm-hmm. had premonitions or whatever, mm-hmm. visions. Anyway, they took these records to Brigham Young to translate, and he refused. Later, mm-hmm. they were taken to David O. McKay.
And he also refused.
And he said, we can't do it.
Mm-hmm.
So then eventually...
So much for the spirit of prophecy.
So, yeah. And then eventually there are... Cloudpiler and others that work with him, and they bring forth these records.
Okay.
So,
and what's the name of this? The Mentina Archives?
Mentina Archives. So they're...
Mentinah.
Whatever.
I can tell everybody listening that you can find information about Cloudpiler and such on the internet.
Okay.
One of the other things we're going to talk about, I could find nothing on, and I understand getting there, but let's talk about this now.
It helped us realize, you know what? The church leaders aren't going to come up with a sealed portion either. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a random prophet. I mean, you got Abinadi in the Book of Mormon. You got Old Testament prophets. They seem to show up. They're never really heads of churches. It's going to have to be a prophet like that. So we had that kind of mindset.
Mm-hmm.
So in the Mentina archives, there's actually some alternate explanations of Book of Mormon stories.
Okay.
If you remember the Coriantumr.
I
won't get into it, but there's just an alternate version of that story. Coriantumr isn't the bad guy in the Mentina archives. It's actually the prophet's the bad guy because he,
misinformed.
Apparently Isabel. Is it Isabel?
Isabel the harlot.
The harlot. Yeah. Apparently he converted her.
Ah.
And they actually go out to Hudson Bay area in Canada and settle a community. And so it's fun stories.
I don't want to be disrespectful. This sounds like Book of Mormon fan fiction.
For sure.
It's like, who's this weird character? Let's make a whole universe. Like, I don't know if you guys are familiar with what has gone on with the Star Wars universe and the amount of books that are written. Like, it's impossible to even track anymore. And this sounds like, here's this one name. Let's write a whole series of stories about this person.
So Hagoth the Son, back to the fan fiction part. Hagoth the Son, the one that's never heard from again in the Book of Mormon, he actually, his descendants come back to the mainland again and tell the story of what happened to him. So you can read that in one of the later volumes of the Mentina Archives.
How many volumes of the Mentina Archives are there?
I think there's around 12 at the moment, but I don't know. Exactly.
So is Cloudpiler still around and doing this?
He started his own community out in the Midwest somewhere.
Okay.
We haven't kept up with his doings.
I can't imagine why.
Okay, so I'll...
So moving on.
Our youngest daughter was the first one to actually leave the area to go to college. She went up to BYU, Idaho.
Mm-hmm.
And by the end of her first year, she was engaged. Her fiancé drives her home at the end of the school year. And we all fly together out to one of the Carolinas to meet his family. Mm-hmm. And while I'm there and meeting his family, they were John Birchers like us. They were easy for us to get to know and love.
It's a match made in pre-existence Saturday's Warrior stuff.
I happened to share with him about, the Mentina Archives and showed him where to find it on the internet.
And when was this? What year?
So that was in April of 2007.
Okay.
So by time they came out to the wedding,
mm-hmm.
he had read more volumes than we had. And he had decided that he needed to move out to a safer place, a refuge place.
Okay.
So he's all looking around Manti and
Snowflake.
Trying to find a good defendable space.
Yes. Right. The kids actually upped their wedding date to June instead of August, but the reception was set for August. So, they actually came up twice. That gave this family two times to come and kind of look around. Mm-hmm. Well, after the reception is when Alan was going to meet up with a group of preparedness-minded people to learn preparedness skills from Cloudpiler up in Blanding area of Utah. Okay.
So Cloudpiler was supposed to come, and there was this other group from Iowa that was going to teach us brain tanning and those kind of survival type skills, you know, mountain man type skills.
You guys will survive. I'm just going to roll over and die when that happens. So
our daughter's father-in-law decides he's going to attend it with Alan. So it left the women to go out and do the open house the other side
we
of the country.
We left them on their own. This is much more important than some wedding reception.
Some wedding reception. We need to learn how to do brain tanning, whatever that is. I'm assuming it has to do with drying out brains, but...
No, using the brain to tan. You rub it on the...
It softens the hide.
Like I said, in a worldwide apocalypse, I'm just going to give up. People can eat me, whatever.
So, when Alan comes home from this outing, he's got a recording of things you listen to. So why don't you tell about that event?
So this group from Iowa shows up, and we were expecting Cloudpiler as well, but he doesn't show.
We learned really, two leaders butting heads. One of them had to break down, and he was the one that...
So this group, when we first got there, they told us, why don't we just pool all our food and we'll just... Our women will cook the food and we'll just all eat it together. And we thought, that's probably a pretty good idea rather than have six different campfires going. Let's just have one. And they had a stove they brought with them. So fine and dandy. So they started telling us about their religion. They were an ex-RLDS group that had broken away from the RLDS church about 20 years earlier. So this is the late 80s.
Okay.
When the RLDS Church was de-emphasizing the Book of Mormon and giving women the priesthood. Mm-hmm. So they thought this is apostate. Mm-hmm. We're going to break off, start our own religion. So William Livingston and most of his family and a few friends decided to start this new religion. Mm-hmm. And they called it the Brotherhood of Christ Church. Now, Livingston, when he was a 14-year-old, he had this idea that he was going to be a prophet when he was older. Mm-hmm. And he claims to have a vision, the same vision that Isaiah was shown in the Old Testament.
In fact, he said he opened the book of Isaiah. And see, we knew it was important to study Isaiah. Mm-hmm. He'd gone to education classes. We've been working on this.
It's the cryptic book that you have to try and understand.
Right. So he had put this on his lap and pleaded with the Lord, please explain this. No one else can explain it. And then here in his youth like that, he was shown that same vision and he could explain every verse and the meanings and the symbolism.
He essentially was a prophet.
Mm-hmm.
He claimed to be a prophet.
I guess he kept that inside for some time. And in the RLDS church, he was...
He had to have enough time to actually figure out what he was claiming. So I'm sorry.
I'm sure. But he was he represented the RLDS church to the Lamanites.
Okay.
And so he had come out to tribes out here, actually, in the
Chinle,
West.
Arizona. He spent a lot of time in Chinle with his family. And he was the RLDS Lamanite representative.
So he learned a lot from Lamanite culture. From Indian.
So his religion American is based on some of Isaiah, some of the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Book of Mormon, plus the sealed portion of the Brother of Jared.
Yeah, let's talk about that. I want to take a picture of this if it's okay so we can put it up on the website. I want to talk about the sealed portion of the Brother of Jared. I've heard of, these sealed portion of the Book of Mormon. And you guys are familiar with Christopher Nemelka, who's done a lot of right. this sort of thing as well. I've never heard of the sealed portion of The Brother of Jared. And this is volume two that you have here.
I just did the cover.
Yeah, well.
Because he brought volume one, and the covers are exactly the same
okay.
on yeah. both except for the volume number.
So what drove this? Like, this is William Livingston.
So his story is, that he, older as an adult, there came a point around the time of breaking off. He fasted for 40 days. So he described that fast for us off on his own. And it was during that time he was shown how to make his own Urim and Thummim, the spectacles mm-hmm. and device to...
The breastplate.
The breastplate, right.
That version of the Urim and Thummim.
Yes, you can kind of see it in that picture.
Yeah. I'm going to take so many pictures of this, but okay. you all are missing out. I'm going to try and get these up on the website.
And then there's stories, you see these tablets pictured mm-hmm. here, of various ways they came. He came into possession of them. He claims these are the actual tablets, or replicas of the tablets mm-hmm. that Jared wrote on. That they didn't have the handwriting we did, these symbolic tablets.
Okay.
So these tablets only have a few
they're not,
pictograms on them.
Yeah, they're not terribly complicated either.
No, and no. How he got the two volumes of the sealed portion from those... very uncomplicated pictograms I don't know. But he did.
Well, he would describe, in fact, he said, Joseph Smith should have given more details on how he,
translated
the Book of Mormon. But Livingston would actually, you can see him just sitting there mm-hmm. with not too much in front of him, but it would have a vision, a panorama of visions mm-hmm. and scenes, and he'd focus in on one. So like he saw in vision Adam and Eve and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So he would interpret what he was seeing
okay.
and write. He would speak it and had several people write it down so that you could have an accurate.
This picture is so creepy just because everybody's in the white robes and.
Well, that's the way they dress in their community.
So
we'll get into that.
Yeah. So you came home with a recording of, and this, lectures. I'm assuming this William Livingston was the other person up at this retreat or what have you.
Yes.
Correct. So we didn't really learn much brain tanning, learned essentially about his religion.
Mm-hmm.
And he started off by explaining the differences between the 1832 Book of Commandments and the mm-hmm. 1835 Doctrine and Covenants.
He did that at that first meeting?
At that first meeting, yeah. So I had never heard this before. This is something that...
It's kind of a big deal.
It is a big deal, and apparently it was a big enough deal that there was somebody in the RLDS Church that wrote a book about it,
mm-hmm.
where he compared side by side the RLDS Doctrine and Covenants and the Book of Commandments, and mm-hmm. there's a lot of differences. And I think some Mormon has done the same thing, but I think he was one of the first to do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that we were discussing prior to getting started the idea of Joseph only being the translator of the Book of Mormon and not having the call to restore a church. That's actually found in the original Book of Commandments.
It is.
But it's mm-hmm. not in the Doctrine and Covenants, because by that time Joseph was like, oh, wait a second.
So naturally we were very diligent students mm-hmm. and studied all these changes and comparisons and mm-hmm. pondered all this.
So the sealed portion of the Brother of Jared is essentially visions that the brother of Jared, who's called Achi mm-hmm. in the books, has about historical events that happened.
Okay.
And apparently there's 24 high priest communities, starting with Adam.
Mm-hmm.
And his, you know, it's kind of I kind of think that, remember how in the Book of Mormon, how Joseph mentions himself
mm-hmm.
in the Book of Mormon? Well, the second mm-hmm. to the last, where it says Gocher Harem the Third,
mm-hmm.
okay, that's his high priest community, William Livingston's high priest community. And I find it interesting that Joseph Smith mentions himself,
mm-hmm.
and Livingston mentions himself in his book of scripture.
It's interesting where you brought up the idea that William Livingston, even as a child, had this idea in his mind that he would be a prophet. And I mm-hmm. think especially a lot of LDS men, kind of harbor that, like, what if I'm going to be the president of the church someday or what have you? And there's a really simple way to have that happen, and that's to break off from your religion and start a new one. And bam, there you are.
But, you know, as a, I had anticipated that the sealed portion would cover the history of the earth. Wasn't that part of it, right? From Adam on down. So it was fulfilling that expectation with these 24 high priest communities. So it made sense. We had taken an Old Testament class together when we first moved out of Saudi Arabia into Mesa, and learned about how there was always the Melchizedek priesthood on the church, even though the Israelites, most of them didn't have it, but there was always at least somebody alive. And so this kind of also fit in with that mindset of there being high priest leaders always on the earth.
Livingston came up with his sealed portion of the Brother Jared at about the same time as Krishnamurti came up with his.
Okay.
And so Livingston told me about a conversation that him and Nemelka had, and Nemelka said, "You can't publish yours. I was first." Or, you know, this, I'm the true prophet. You're just the apostate, you know.
So what was it about the Livingston that drew you guys to him as opposed to continuing on with Cloud Piler, or even
he seemed more like a prophet than any prophet we would ever run across in church history.
Yeah, he lived a lot more simple life. You know, he wasn't caught up in worldliness at all. In fact, a lot of the sealed portion was talking about connecting more with nature, being close to the Lord through nature. That nature speaks to us and teaches us about God.
And you guys had similar feelings in terms of the same way that you felt that again, we would call it the Brighamite branch of the church was true. You guys had similar feelings pointing you in this direction, feelings of the spirit or whatever you would call it.
We kind of felt led to at least explore it. I mean, as missionaries, you teach. How do you know if something's true? You try living it. We were willing to try it out.
They don't teach that anymore. Sorry. I make too many snide comments. I apologize, everybody.
But somehow we had that willingness to explore and out front, and we figured we could figure out.
Were you still attending regularly?
Oh, yes.
I'm still working in the temple.
Okay.
Wow. He was still working in the temple, and the lessons in Sunday school that year were about the coming forth of the sealed portion. I contemplated leaving a couple copies on our teacher's door step, but I didn't.
I don't know. You could have done it anonymously, and it probably would have been okay. But if you would have been like, "Hey, I found this great thing," you guys are exploring these.
Could this possibly be it? We wanted to figure it out, and we figured eventually the Lord would help us know.
Would point you in the right direction. So,
we weren't real anxious to talk to about too many people yet.
At the beginning, we didn't see the discrepancies between, I mean, there's a complete gulf between Livingston's religion and Mormonism, but
we didn't pick up on it.
But in the things that were important to you, it was almost like they dovetailed.
Perfect. Yes. The whole preparedness mindset, the whole, you know, seeking to know God, do God's will.
So where did that living
a Zion community. I mean, we knew we, got to get back to those Zion communities like the early pioneers.
So we were invited to go out to Iowa.
Okay.
And visit them. They live near Lamoni, Iowa, which is where the RLDS University is.
Okay.
It's kind of the Provo of
the Provo of the Community of Christ.
Or the RLDS back in those days. Right. So their university is in Lamoni, and he lives just a few miles from Lamoni, just north of the border there. They live what kind of lifestyle would you say it is, Julie?
It's close to Amish.
Okay. No electricity. No running water.
And are they doing everything in common? And
everything's in common. And they've been doing this for 20 years now, so they've got a lot of experience.
That was looking more successful than a lot of the early church efforts.
And the United Order that
when I say 20 years, it was 20 years back then in 2007.
And so they're still there now. They're still 7 years ahead. And they're still, there's a lot to be said for that. That's interesting. So you went out there and visited.
We stayed with one of the families. One of the families. In fact, she was one of these translators, one of the scribes that you see in this picture here.
Okay.
Everybody had two names. They had their special name that Livingston was inspired to give them. So this sounded cool. A new name, individually inspired.
Yeah.
Rather than
based on the date.
Not based
and
on
you
the
being
date.
A temple worker, you knew how that whole situation worked. I knew about it. My dad told me it was like, my dad told me he had forgotten his name and he had to go back. I'm like, oh, we'll just look up when you went through. And they gave him his name and he's like, mm-hmm. Well, now that's weird. And he told me that before I had gone through. But again, this is one of those things where I found out so early that nothing fazed me further on. So.
Right. But anyway, that seemed kind of cool.
I'm kind of interested in how they actually applied no gasoline, no electricity to their community. And so they had this washing machine and it was attached to a pulley system, and attached to the pulley system was
they had a horse walk around.
A horse walk around and he would turn this pulley, which would turn a belt and turn the washing machine. And I thought, well, that's a pretty good idea, but very inefficient.
So the clotheslines out there by the horse circle, and you'd take your turn out there for your laundry.
And they built this stuff themselves. Mm-hmm. Just took a regular washing machine and put this belt on it. And
what happened after that?
Well, first of all, the father-in-law of our daughter decided that he was going to move to Blanding.
Okay,
where the powwow first took place with Livingston and his group.
Is that's near where Cloud Piler was doing his stuff too, or?
No, actually, Cloud Piler found the Mentina archives up in the San Pete Valley.
Okay.
He was shown where they were up there, and he translated them.
Okay.
Him and some others.
So your in-laws, your daughter's in-laws, are deciding they found the right place in Blanding.
And Livingston decided he found the right couples because he had in mind that he needed to have another community out here that could be a refuge for Mormons.
He had this idea.
LDS folk, yes.
That his church was going to save the LDS church from destruction.
In the coming calamities.
In the coming calamities. Yeah. That was his idea. So he thought that us, the three couples, us and two other couples, were the key to unlocking the LDS church.
And saving it from itself.
And saving it from itself. And we thought to ourselves, you know, I have absolutely no influence on anybody.
I mean, this is in 2007.
But, you know,
right?
You never know.
My kids don't even listen to me, let alone somebody else in the ward.
You never know what miracles God can do. Mm-hmm. We'll just take one step at a time. Okay. So we proceeded. You know, our relatives to our daughter that actually put up the money to get some land in that area.
Okay. So they purchased about 80 acres east of Blanding. The Iowa community comes out and is going to build us three cabins.
Okay.
And we have to supply the materials. So I go into debt to acquire these materials to build these three cabins. And they're just basic, basic cabins. There's no running water. There's no electricity in them either.
A place to lay down and go when it rains.
It's a lot easier to build a home if you don't worry about those things, you know?
So they come out, they build these three cabins for us. Go ahead, Julie.
I want to backtrack a little and just say Livingston came out several times, and we would meet there in Blanding at people's homes and learn more and more. And he was preparing us, teaching us how to run a community. We got lots of lessons how to do, how to have common consent. He taught us more of his scriptures. He had taught Isaiah via the radio, and we were able to download all his lectures on Isaiah and listen and study those. Then it was in December he came out. We all went out onto the property and had a special dedication ceremony, which I've got my notes from a lot of details of doing that. But I'll say it was a lot more like maybe what Indians would have done than anything LDS did. Very, very ceremonial and symbolic and speaking four directions and laying out, showing the arikadeshi is a word for your nature there, and setting this land aside for the purpose. So it's like, ready or not, hey, the time the community can come out and build cabins, and we're going, are we ready yet? We haven't had time to save up money or anything, but here they come. He was really kind of pushing us ahead with this. And we just kind of kept up.
Okay. And while all this is going on, have you guys stopped attending your
regular? No, we're still going.
You're still going. So you're kind of, you're walking on.
We're walking on thin ice on both.
Yeah. You're kind of got 1 foot in one and 1 foot in the other.
Exactly.
You're kind of feeling like you're forced to put both feet in.
You know, you screen out things mm-hmm. that are unacceptable to you. I still had kids getting married in the temple.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you know what? He didn't confront us on that. He helped me feel, you know, like down the line, I might gain a new understanding, but he respected where we were mm-hmm. and took us slowly enough in that way. Mm-hmm. But no, I was still comfortable going to the temple.
Okay.
One of their, the things you learn in the SEAL portion of the Brother Jared is that they have a very interesting take on the war in heaven.
Okay.
Okay. Now the war in heaven, from a Mormon perspective, it's fought between the righteous and the wicked spirits mm-hmm. that.
Well, they're wicked or righteous depending on whether they choose to follow Satan's plan or Jesus' plan. Very.
In the SEAL portion of the Brother Jared, these wicked and righteous are actually elements of the earth. So, okay. For example, fire is the leader of the righteous elements, and he's followed by wind, mountains, rocks, thunder, trees, rain, hills, rivers, clouds, etc. Mm-hmm. The leader of the wicked elements is called, is the meteorite, kind okay. of the idea of falling from heaven.
Mm-hmm. The star that falls from heaven.
Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of kind of significance there. And so he's followed by meteor, copper, coal, phosphorus, marble, petroleum, mm-hmm. generate electricity, arsenic, lead.
A lot of things uh-huh. that are toxic.
That are toxic.
They're toxic. Okay. So those are the fallen watchers, they call them. Mm-hmm. He calls them the Decadarchy, which is kind of a really weird term. And the watchers of holiness, the righteous elements, are called mm-hmm. the Arikideshi.
I'm not even creative enough to come up with the names for something like this, let alone all the stories.
Yeah. So this war in heaven is mm-hmm. still going on today, according to this sealed okay. portion.
So naturally, they want their community to not have the Decadarchy in
yeah,
it.
Not
as far as electricity.
Or coal or
copper yeah. pipes.
Okay.
That kind of thing, you know.
So it was a process for them to gradually eliminate more things. Mm-hmm. You know, like the day came they realized, hey, these bikes that we're using to get around mm-hmm. maybe aren't acceptable either.
Wow. But they've just about eliminated all the Decadarchy, if you want to call uh-huh. it that, from their community.
I don't know if there's another name for it. So, back to this, they're coming out to build the cabins.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And the cabins went up.
The cabins went up.
Are they still up as far
They're
as
still you know? Up, but we don't own the property anymore.
Okay.
Then
what?
There was some contention between two of the families. One family was kind of very followed grandpa, followed Livingston to the very nth degree.
Mm-hmm.
And another one was looked at it from kind of a cafeteria approach. And so there
was a little more standing up for what his own guidance,
mm-hmm.
inner guidance was telling him.
Right.
So eventually, because of the arguments that ensued between them, the one that followed Livingston actually left the community. He was the one that purchased the property.
Mm.
It was in his name, essentially. And he moved back to Iowa. Or not back, but he moved to Iowa.
Yeah, and their family.
And they still are there today. And then they proceeded to follow a lawsuit against the rest of us trying to get back the property because it had been...
Well, we first went through lots of letters trying to straighten us out because we were apparently had some beliefs and practices that were not acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
And we needed to use their vocabulary more.
They were very against New Age stuff. Okay. They thought it was devilish.
Quantum touch healing,
mm-hmm.
circle variety, and goal setting. I don't know. Just some of the habits this other couple had and the way mm-hmm. they'd expressed themselves just weren't acceptable.
Mm-hmm. Now, this other couple, was this a couple? Sorry,
It's actually the other couple was the one who hosted the whole
okay.
gathering.
Gotcha. So they there's this couple, there's your daughters-in-laws and you. You're the three
right.
families. Okay. Great. Sorry, now that I know where we are.
That's fine.
So you've got all this infighting.
So, yeah, so after the one family left, we actually had, in the meantime, met another couple that came in and took over finishing building that third cabin.
Okay.
So there was always three of us involved. Mm-hmm. So basically two couples that actually lived on the property, we were only visiting mm-hmm. and helping build when we visited. Mm-hmm. Support, gave a lot of support, helped bring when up you, food.
You paid for the bulk of the materials for all of the cabins or?
Two of the families paid okay. for the bulk of the materials, and then the one family that went to live in Iowa purchased the property.
Okay.
So,
eventually we weren't living well enough for him to feel comfortable with us just gradually paying him off. We had to either get a loan mm-hmm. or get off the property.
Or get off the property.
And so, I mean, we were enjoying the experience and mm-hmm. still into trying hard enough there. It took a while to realize, oh, you know what? There's not enough water in the well anyway to be able to support the crops. Mm-hmm. It's probably in our best interest.
Just give it back to him.
Just to give it back. Walk away.
Because none of us were willing to fork out the money. Actually, Alan and I contemplated selling our home to be able to do it.
Mm-hmm. It was home that you still have down in Gilbert, right?
Yes. I mean, because of that attitude of being willing to sacrifice and give anything to the mm-hmm. Lord. I tell you, when we were newlyweds, the pressure to donate to welfare back those was mm-hmm. tremendous. This idea of sacrifice, mm-hmm. sacrifice. And so it was that a moment in time where I thought, if the Lord asked me to, I would sell my home. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, that's the kind of faith I had.
You guys were hardcore.
We were Kool-Aid drinkers, all right.
So you.
In the meantime, we learned that our children valued that property and wanted it to be a homecoming place. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of changed our attitude now to be there. Mm-hmm. We had built it with the idea of dying there, that this is it. This is our
your home.
So, we're back to feeling that
way.
The Iowa community, the community in Iowa wrote us. I kind of refer to them as the Iowa community rather than the Brotherhood of Christ Church, but they wrote us several times and said that there were accidents happening on their property that they could only ascertain were a result because we were practicing New Age stuff in our community in Blanding. And we thought to ourselves, How can what we're doing affect you?
And because we're connected.
How's that even material?
So that was another reason why the one couple wanted to leave and go back because we wouldn't stop practicing New Age stuff.
Mm-hmm. Or the other couple.
The other couple.
We were making valid, Alan and I, of course, we were willing to make these shifts, mm-hmm. whatever.
Whatever it took.
So eventually, we decided that it wasn't worth to keep the property, mm-hmm. and we just deeded it back to him with the cabins on it, and we lost a bunch of money. Mm-hmm. But
you improved somebody else's property.
I improved somebody else's property, and I had a very valid learning experience.
We enjoyed going up there mm-hmm. and working on it. I was looking up stuff to come and interview with you, mm-hmm. and I saw we had a link to look at the land via Google Maps, Google I guess. Earth. It zeroed in on there. I still had such warm feelings looking at that because of the positive times. Mm-hmm. One of the things was, you know, as couples, when we'd go up, of course, we'd meet and we had a lot of things to address, a lot of problems to figure out and, you know, and creating this. And then there was all this religious aspects of it because mm-hmm. they were very key to the whole operation of the community. It mm-hmm. was founded on principles of like faith in Christ and repentance and common consent and all these things. So we had to work out and get used to these. And so I remember zeroing in and really talking about repentance. What was our views? It was refreshing to have such open, honest, mm-hmm. candid, questioning conversations. And I didn't realize until we experienced there that I had never experienced that kind of open discussion in the LDS church. Mm-hmm. That's when I first saw that it was controlled. And in fact, since then I've recognized it's really controlled.
It's a very tight-handled message.
We started seeing all the rules that the Livingston Group live by. And we started to see, you know, they're even more controlling than the LDS Church is. Mm-hmm. And why would we want to exchange one form of control for an even greater form of control?
Mm-hmm. This might seem like a strange question. Were you thinking in terms of control at that point? Is that kind of the jumping off point for where you guys began your journey away, or?
Yes.
Yes, that was the point where everything changed.
Livingston came across as it was to be in a council, to have a community. We each had to have the Spirit of the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was true our whole lives in the LDS Church. Seeking to follow the guidance of the Holy Ghost was an important thing to us. So having this community that maybe we'll make some progress on this mm-hmm. area. We're going to learn more about hearing the Spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And a moment for me, we were invited to go back to what, an event they call In-Gathering. And it's, we'll have, like, wards will go on a camping mm-hmm. trip together. Maybe you could compare it to that. Okay. So their community consists of, what, three different villages.
Okay.
So all the village members gather to one area, and rather than tents, they build
grass huts.
And they had one built for us when mm-hmm. we got there. We were invited to come.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like a week, most of a week.
Mm-hmm.
So their youth have time to like play volleyball together, mm-hmm. but it also consists of lectures with Livingston.
With Livingston. Now, does he have a title that he uses other than?
They call him Grandpa.
Okay.
So many family members.
And that's what we call them.
Okay.
When you were there with him. Hey, Grandpa.
Now, were any of the people that you associated with back home in your local ward, were they aware of how into any of this? Did you talk about this with any other members of the?
We shared a little bit with them. Uh-huh. With one couple, but most of our family knew nothing of what we were doing.
My mother knew. She actually went up with this to Blanding mm-hmm. and helped work on our cabin.
Okay.
Go ahead and finish the story.
So yeah,
my story here
is the grass huts.
We're in the grass huts, and so as we walk, they're kind of in a line. And Livingston had a sister who was a little handicapped,
mm-hmm.
and she would be in front of her hut, and I would stop and say hi and visit her. And one time, I just shared with her this strong desire to really know that I'm getting inspired by the Spirit, the Holy Ghost. I'm listening to God. And she said, yeah, that's what I'm working on too. And I go, you've been here all 20 years. You've been working on it and you're still struggling with it. I mean, I didn't say that aloud to her, but inside I'm going, red flag.
Yeah. Well, it's got to be one of those things like, wait a second.
And then see this third, this couple who was like in trouble,
mm-hmm.
they observed, and we could see how the community members still relied on Livingston.
Mm-hmm.
If they couldn't get the answer from God, well, we better ask Livingston. He'll get it for us. So this overly relying on one man to be the one who was good at communicating with God.
To be the middleman for your
salvation.
Kind
of reminds you of the LDS Church, doesn't it?
A little bit.
Just a little bit. So, that's when, gradually you start looking and comparing and seeing what's mm-hmm. really going on in the lives of people.
Mm-hmm.
And you start recognizing how much you rely on someone else's opinion, what God said. And mm-hmm. another thing that was important to me was this community, they didn't even use knives. They didn't, there was a lot of things they didn't do. They did dance and have some good times, but
they used knives in woodworking, but they wouldn't cut food with knives.
Well, of course.
I mean, that relates to an Old Testament story whatever.
All weird behaviors relate to an Old Testament story somewhere.
But I think about the peoples of the world and people's talents and gifts. You think of those, Olympic people, mm-hmm. artists, musicians. Well, there's a lot of the world out there that this community was excluding.
Mm-hmm.
And in my mind, I'm sorry, everybody is a child of God. And so I'm thinking, you know what? You can't trust any one person's relationship to God to be the path for you personally. I thought, God relates to every one of us. And I felt like I'm going to understand God better if I learn from a greater variety of people. Mm-hmm. Every child, every person can teach me something of who I am, who we are together. As time's gone on, I'm even more and more having mm-hmm. that kind of perspective. I enjoy learning from a wide variety of people's experience. But for my personal growth and journey, it's between me and God. Mm-hmm. Nobody else in between. I can learn a lot from other people. I can get hints. Yeah. But so there's not a middleman in my life. Well,
once you had that realization, was that the big aha moment where this lifetime of participation in an organization started to not
be
make
so
sense?
Important? Yeah.
Right. There were a lot of aha moments.
Okay. And so this sounds like this was like a big moment for you, mm-hmm. for you, Julie. What about you, Alan?
It was just a very gradual process.
Very, very gradual.
It took, I'm guessing 3 or 4 years before, because I had to lose the LDS mindset in the process. And the LDS mindset only looks at something from a specific angle. Mm-hmm. And you exclude all other angles.
Mm-hmm. You gotta put on the blinders.
You put on the blinders. And it took me a long time for me to see things from other people's perspectives and realize that they're just as valid as the LDS perspective. And so I've come to the conclusion that there really is no right or wrong way anymore. Mm-hmm. There's only ways.
There's just ways.
We're here getting experience. And you have to have the protagonist and the antagonist to have an experience, don't you?
Yeah. That's very consistent with my wife's interpretation of the world in terms of everybody's experience is just as valid. Mm-hmm. And we need the drug addicts as much as we need the saints. Because otherwise the human experience doesn't have everything.
Right.
Right.
You need the Hitler and the Joseph Smith. You need the
Livingston.
Unfortunately.
The cloud piler.
So once you guys came to that conclusion that the value that you had previously placed on the LDS church was not as valuable to you, what happened then?
I still consider my experience in the LDS church to be part of my personal path of mm-hmm. growth.
I don't have any regrets for being LDS.
Okay.
Other than maybe the tithing money.
Wow. Isn't that the universal regret?
But I
loved it. I was a happy LDS, you know?
I don't have any regrets for all the experiences I had, all the sacrifice I have. I don't have any regrets for that because I believe it prepared me for where I am today. Mm-hmm. And without those experiences, I wouldn't be able to see life from all the angles that I see it from now, which is just more beautiful.
So, your family, are they all okay with you guys? And
you know, we know that it's hard for those that have that strong testimony. Mm-hmm. They ache for us and hope that we'll come back into the fold. From our point of view, it is like being in this big, beautiful world and wanting to cram us back in a little box. It's not going to work. Mm-hmm. We won't fit mm-hmm. anymore.
I'm trying to have this not sound.
So, but I love the LDS people. We're mm-hmm. still comfortable associating them. Our neighborhood is, who do we know? All the LDS people in our neighborhood.
They just built a temple in our neighborhood.
You guys are somehow lifelong members.
Yeah, we are. And
you've raised 8 children.
Yes.
Correct. You're older than I am.
Yeah.
So I, in terms of my relating to your experience, it's a little more difficult because my children were all very young. Do you guys have any advice for people like yourselves, people who might have their children grown and have their have lived in the same home for 30 years or what have you, in terms of
how to
handle it, how to interact.
You know, you have to come to the point of being okay with everybody's journey. Mm-hmm. And I'd have to remind myself, let them be LDS and enjoy it. I loved it. Nobody could have come and told me
that you're wrong.
That I'm wrong.
You just have to accept everybody from a non-judgmental point of view. And that's the most difficult thing in the entire world.
Not take it so serious.
No judgment.
Yeah, well, but if you really boil it down, isn't that precisely what all the great spiritual teachers end up with? Is like, Don't be a jerk. Be cool with everybody.
Right.
Try and keep that judgment to a zero if
possible.
Christ
really meant it when he said, judge not.
Judge not, listen, you know. Well, every great spiritual teacher through history, it boils down to that. It's like you can't look at somebody else and say, you're no good.
I wish I could have got it 60 before 60 years went by, but it's fine the way it is.
Oh, we're glad we went on the adventure together.
Oh.
That we stayed close as a couple. We communicated a lot.
Yeah. Did you guys have any stress in your relationship as a couple as you went through this, or were you kind of having this parallel?
It was experience? A parallel journey. We always communicated. We always shared the things we were learning about historicity, about the Book of Mormon problems and Doctrine and Covenants problems. We never kept it up from each other.
Okay.
Now, she always reacted well to that. Now, there's other couples where that isn't necessarily the case.
Yes. You're of the lucky ones.
Some spouses feel threatened by that information. Mm-hmm. My wife never did.
Well, it seems like you guys were always open to information. I mean, based on that, part of the reason I was so excited to talk to you guys, because it's so outside. I was raised in a very, very rigid, correlated mindset. Like I'd mentioned to you before, my dad and I once had an hour and a half argument over the fact that I wore a blue shirt to stand in the circle and bless my brother's kid, and that I should be wearing a white shirt because that's the uniform of the priesthood. You know, as I tell people, you know, you can tell the guys who are on a slippery slope at church by the blue shirt and the beard. You know,
and that's one of my epiphanies was how judgmental I had been of members of the church.
Mm-hmm. But it is a part of the culture.
When we first went out to visit the Iowa community the first time, they have a round building that they meet for their church. It's got the bench all the way around the outside edge. I remember being in there and Livingston coming in. And one of the things they had us do in that service was introduce ourselves a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, if you think, you know, we have 8 children. My mother has 52 grandchildren and now almost as many great-grandchildren.
Yikes.
So we relate, you know, I relate the size of family and that we're close to family. And Livingston came up. So he got to know us a little bit there. And I think he came up to us and said that he'd had a dream about us, learned about, you know, revelation on our behalf. And he said, one thing he learned is that we were close as a couple. He could see us a very strong couple. And the other was that our first mission was with our family. Of course, that makes sense to me when I look back at it now. Yes, he would want us to
bring our family with us.
Bring
And that dawned on me at the time, but just no, but it resonated that yes, I have a calling at loving and caring for my family. And that's what I naturally That's what I do love doing.
That's what you keep doing.
I was the oldest of 9 kids and nurtured my siblings a lot anyway, letting alone my own children and helping with nieces and nephews. I now know I don't need to save the whole world. I don't really have that responsibility, and that's kind of a relief now with my new mindset, but. Just thought I'd share that.
Any other thoughts you'd like to? It seems like we're coming up on a pretty natural ending point.
Yeah,
anything
I think we
else?
Are. The only thing I have to say is that I recently went online and tried to find Livingston's group. It's not on the internet anymore. So they've completely isolated themselves even more so than they were before.
Well, the internet uses generated electricity.
Well, yes, they were very limited on how many members could even visit a library and use it.
But if anybody wants, I have an electronic copy on my computer of the sealed portion. If anybody wants it, just email me and I'll be glad to send it to you.
Well, what we'll probably have people do is email voices@mormonexpression.com and then Katrina or myself can get in touch with you to pass that along. Mm-hmm. Just so we don't throw your email out there to however many, I don't know how many people listen to the podcast, but.
True. That's a good idea.
It's enough that, and then if anybody, would feel like communicating anything with you, they can also email voices@mormonexpression.com.
I want to share a little something about the experience of reading. Naturally, we read the sealed portion, and he also had received the Book of Remembrance of Enoch, which gives a lot more details of the Garden of Eden. And in the script, you can call them scripture. There were scriptures to these people, okay? And they felt like it to us. But the one thing I really liked about it is God, the name they use in these for God is Enoki said, but that word means loving kindness. He was consistently portrayed as a loving, kind God. Mm-hmm. And some of the Old Testament stories are retold in a different way. And it felt really good. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed this different possibility of how history might have been.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it seems like you can parlay that forward in terms of, it seems like at this point you're just approaching your life from a space of love and acceptance of people's journeys. And and often that seems to stem from a desire for our own journeys to be validated. You guys are beautiful people. This has been such a good time for me. I really appreciate you coming and doing the podcast.
Thanks for inviting us.
Super helpful. So, we're going to finish up now. Again, if you want to get copies of any of the things that the Shahs have, you can email voices@mormonexpression.com. And also, if you would like to be a guest on the podcast, also send your story into voices@mormonexpression.com and someone will get back to you. Thank you again so much, guys. This was fantastic.
Thank you.
Heartbreaking by my time.